Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, poisonees. Welcome to another episode of Expert Witness, our bonus series where we talk to special guests about some of the content we share on the show. Poison, true crime, cocktails, madness, and more. From historians and psychotherapists to authors and doctors, we love to get different perspectives on crime, poison, and entertainment itself from people from all walks of life with different areas of expertise. In this episode, we are talking to Tonya Mitchell, author of the new book, The Arsenic Eater's Wife. Tonya Mitchell is not only an established author of gothic fiction, but she is a fan of The Poisoner's Cabinet. The Arsenic Eater's Wife is a piece of gothic fiction, but it is inspired by the very famous case of Florence Maybrick, which The Poisoner's Cabinet have covered before. We were lucky to read an advance copy of the book, and we were also very honoured to give an endorsement on the back cover. Very, very happy to see that there. We spoke to Tonya about the process of writing this book. How does one turn a famous true crime story into compelling fiction while still staying true to the characters and taking people on a roller coaster journey? We also chat about the appeal of the gothic to modern readers and Tonya's own process for writing. Enjoy. Hello, Tonya. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you.
Where are you? Where are you now? Where are you speaking from?
I am in the United States in Ohio, which is in the Midwest, near Cincinnati, if that means anything to anyone. And I'm down in my basement office.
Oh, nice. Is that the writing den?
It's the writing cave. Yes, there are no windows, which is a good thing. I cannot track the passage of time. Also a good thing.
Getting into the process already, which I love. Oh, we'll have to come back
like
to that.
It's like a casino in that way.
Let's start off by saying congratulations on The Arsenic Eater's Wife that is now published. It's available in the US and in the UK, inspired by a famous true crime case. And you very kindly offered us the chance to read it and also blurb on it as well, for which we were absolutely blown away. And we're really, really happy to be able to endorse the book. And The Arsenic Eater's Wife was just such a joy to read. It really, really was wonderful to read. So congratulations.
Thank you.
How are you feeling about everything?
It's been out about a month now. It was a month yesterday. And I'm really, really happy with how it's doing. The reviews coming in are very good. I worked over a year on this project. A lot of that was research, which can be very dry at times. But the story just kept unfolding all these onion layers that was just... It was just a joy to write in the end. And I'm so glad that it's out now. It's like, I call it, I have three children. This is my fifth child. My fourth book was my fourth child. This is now my fifth child, The Arsenic Eater's Wife. So that's how important they are, because they take so long to happen. So it's nice when they're out.
Well, we have to start off with a very important question. What are you drinking?
I'm drinking coffee right now. I'm sorry. It's the morning.
That's good. I just have a Diet Coke. I haven't hit the liquor yet. Because it's 11 a.m. when at the time of this recording where you are.
Right.
You could slip something into your coffee if you wanted to. But I'll leave
that
with
you. I could slip some Baileys in. Yeah.
And it's 4 p.m. over here in England. But I'm just on a Diet Coke because otherwise I won't get through this. Just need the caffeine.
I'm here. I get it.
So, Tonya, it'd be great. I think it's best if you can put into words, really. You are a listener of the show, you're a fan of the show, which is wonderful, and there's a little bit of how the book came about, but it would be great if you could just introduce a bit about yourself as an author and about the book, The Arsenic Eater's Wife.
Well, my name is Tanya Mitchell. I'm an author. I don't always feel like an author because it's not a very glamorous life down in my writing cave, trying not to be distracted by things. It's not my first book. My first book came out in 2020. Not the best year for anything to come out, especially a debut book, because the world was a dumpster fire, basically, because of COVID. But what I didn't know then and what a lot of publishers didn't know until they looked back was that it was actually a pretty good year for reading because so many people were in lockdown that people were starting to pick up books. So it wasn't as bad as I thought that it was going to be. I did have to cancel a lot of events and signings and things like that. So that wasn't great. But it was a great experience for me. And I actually found this story. It was around about 2021. My family and I went to Washington, D.C. on spring break. And all of the Smithsonian's were closed because of COVID still. And so we were going to have a couple days of rain, needed to do something outside or inside, rather. Texted some friends and said, what the heck can we do that is not a Smithsonian that's inside that would be open? And somebody recommended the Spy Museum. I don't know if you've heard of the Spy Museum. It is an excellent, excellent place. And anyway, we all spent a couple hours there. And you know how museums usually dump you into the gift shop? You know, you'll be going right into the gift shop. And I was looking at all of these books. There were just tons and tons of books. Most of them were on spies. But I picked up a book about women called Bad Girls from History.
Yay.
Wicked or Misunderstood. And I thought, you know what? I bet there's a couple women in here that I could research to see if that's the topic of my next book. And sure enough, one of the chapters was on Florence Maybrick. And I got sucked right in. And she is the inspiration as the main character for The Arsenic Eater's Wife. And it was a very short write-up on her in that book, really only maybe like a page. But there was enough in there that I could definitely get sucked down the rabbit hole. And I did, and I started researching it. And then, this is funny, I was on Instagram, and I started to wonder what other people were posting about poisonings. And I started looking at hashtags, and that's where I found the Poisoner's Cabinet. And then I read who you were and what you did, and I thought, these people talk about poisonings, and they have a cocktail each episode. It was like you and Nick had crawled inside my head and said, what would be a perfect podcast for Tanya? That's what it was. So, and you had already done Florence Maybrick, because by the time I found you, I think you were maybe out a year. You were either at the end of the first season or the beginning of the second. I can't quite remember. But I listened to that, and it was great. There's so much about this story that I wanted to tell. So that's how it came about.
Oh, I'm so glad you found us during that time, and that we were there for you with our drinks.
Yes.
Florence Maybrick's story. I mean, it's fascinating. She's one of the ladies that's always mentioned in that breath about, oh, Victorian lady poisoners, Florence Maybrick, because her story is so compelling. It's got all these interesting tidbits through it. But you said, you know, you only read this very short little clip of it in this book before you did your more research. What was it, do you think? Was there one thing that really sucked you in with it that made you go, oh, this is the book?
Yes. It was the fact that her husband, James Maybrick, was a known arsenic eater. It was known by the family. It was known by the friends. It was known by the servants. It was known by the chemists that he would visit sometimes two or three times a day to get what he called his little pick-me-up, which was liquor arsenicalis, which is basically Fowler's solution. Yeah. And I thought, if this guy is widely known to have been an arsenic eater, self-dosing several times a day, why is it she has brought up on charges of poisoning him? Like, why would that even have come about? And that's what I started to pick at. And it just opened up layer after layer of stuff that was going on in that house when he was sick. And it was fascinating.
And for anyone who isn't familiar with the Florence Maybrick story, we'd encourage you, please go and listen to our episode on Florence Maybrick, a very famous case of a woman accused of poisoning her husband, as Tanya has said, was a habitual arsenic user. But there were all sorts of family plots and characters all around. And she stood trial, you know, and was sent to jail, was later released. But there has been mystery around it the whole time of, like, you know, this felt like a miscarriage of justice that people complained about. But you've taken this story, which, and again, and you know, if we read a true crime whole book on it, you'd be fascinated. But you've turned it into a rather delicious gothic fiction book.
Yeah, absolutely.
What was it like transforming her story into fiction? Because, you know, as I said, you could have so easily have written a lyrical, great true crime book, but a nonfiction. I so enjoyed reading this book because I knew the story of Florence Maybrick. I knew the case. I could see one reading through it, all the detail and all the research you'd done, but you'd crafted a story around it as well. And you'd added in elements for, you know, the benefit of fiction readers that drew on the Gothic, that drew on all of those Victorian crime novels that we love. And you added so many layers into it. And I was very impressed that had worked. That worked so well, because it could have so easily gone into, you know, melodrama or people kind of biting off more than they can chew. You know, I think you can see that where people try and create an atmosphere, but you did create this atmosphere. What was it like not only taking her story, but transforming it?
My first draft of it was very closely based on. So all of the characters had their real names. All of the evidence was in there, all of the witnesses, all of the trial testimonies. I was afraid to leave anything out because I wanted to be as true to the story as I could. But the problem with it was that was so weighty, all of that, that I decided that if it became inspired by, then I could drop out some characters, for instance, who weren't that principal in it, or I could combine characters. I could take out a lot of the more weighty evidence that was collected, because there were over like 200 vials of this and that and pills and so forth that were collected from the house. I could take out the stuff that wasn't as interesting and I could make it my own. And then I also decided, because I write Gothic, my first book is Gothic, that I could make it even more so if I changed the name of the house, which was already kind of an old mansion, and I made it have more Gothic elements to it. And then I started thinking, you know, anybody can read her story and how it ended with, you know, after the trial and going to jail and getting out and what happened. Her story was extremely sad. There are so many points in research where I thought, her life can't get any worse than it is right now. And you know what? It would get worse. It just kept getting worse and worse. And I thought, you know, I feel like I owe her something. And if I do this inspired by bit, if I go back and rewrite bits of it and I drop out the more weighty stuff, I could make this story my own and give her an ending that I thought that she deserved. Now, 80% of the book is still exactly what happened.
Yeah.
It's later on what happened when she gets out, and I don't want to say too much, that really, to me, makes it more fiction and makes it more dramatic and gives it a finish that I hope, with its twist in the end, you know, gives readers more of a good fiction reading experience. But I've just said that to you in what, like 2 or 3 minutes? It took me a long time to get there. It's almost like, I think sometimes with writing, you have to write it first the wrong way before you realize, you know what, this is what I need to do. This is the turn that I need to give it. This is going to make it better. And I had several different sessions of that. And ultimately, what I decided to do is the book that's available now. So
fantastic. It's something that I've heard from a lot of authors when I've been to authors' talks and I've done a couple of interviews. And every single one of them says it probably with an air of guilt in their voice of, I wrote it wrong the first time, and then you had to write it, and then you find the book within it. So it's a good lesson, I think, because some people sit down and go, oh, I expect to, you know, just to the words to flow from my fingertips instantly, and they'll instantly be perfect and a little polishing. No, sometimes you have to, it's a real labor of love to get it into shape.
Yeah. I think of the meme of the iceberg that you see on the top of the water and then the iceberg at the bottom. The top of the on the surface above the water is the tiny little peak of the iceberg. And that's what people get when a book comes out. But then you have all that below water, whatever you want to call it. That's the angst and the it's not working. And the first draft, there's a reason it's called the vomit draft, because it's horrible, that first draft that you write. And then all the successive edits and the cuts and the pace and, you know, where does this detail go in and things like that. That's where all the work is. But for me personally, that's where all the joy is, because there's so much going on at that time. You're really discovering the story as you're writing it, which is really the most rewarding part for me.
Absolutely. The characters all the way through it as well, they're really beautifully drawn Gothic characters who are flanking Constance, who is our heroine, who's based on Florence. I have remembered that right, haven't I? Because I was just like, oh,
yes,
God, yeah.
Constance.
But a lot of these characters, wonderful characters that do feel of, you know, classics of Gothic fiction, the family members, the servants, the house and the whispers and the people who, and, you know, who can you trust and what is really happening here? And all the way through, Constance really does go on a journey. Did you feel when you were going through these drafts as well, it's a big responsibility to look after Constance, isn't it? And to in a way, to look after Florence. How did you manage that without being too biased towards her or being too protective, because she has to make decisions through it?
You know, the biggest weakness in Florence and in my character Constance is that she was way too trusting of what was going on around her. If somebody said it was raining, she believed it was raining. If someone acted like a friend, she believed that they were a friend. And in the beginning of the book, there's a lot of her taking in things and not really understanding what's going on behind it. And what was tricky for me was to let the reader know what's really happening and to keep Constance naive and not quite getting it. That was really kind of tricky to write, to inform the reader of something that the character herself doesn't know yet. But as the book continues through the scenes, the various chapters, she starts to really understand what's going on, that everybody in that house is against her. But at the same time, she's also morally gray. Nobody in the book, maybe but her barrister, is a good person. She also has some issues. She's not Lily White. There are definitely things that she's doing, which kind of adds to that. Did she do it or not?
Yeah.
So I tried not to keep her too precious, like, oh, she's the only perfect one, because she wasn't. She's just as morally gray as they are. And by going through the successive scenes, she's learning what she hasn't seen for a long time. And she's getting a lot smarter. So that by the time we find her at trial, she's a very different person. And it's like the scales are falling from her eyes.
It's a real challenge, I think, with Gothic fiction in particular, when you're mixing it with true crime. It's a marriage made in heaven, really, because you can read Gothic, and I've read some modern Gothic books that have wonderful settings, but sometimes my stumbling block is that they've tried to make the heroine just this as pure as the driven snow, just sort of, and that kind of makes her pointless, really. She's just there to move the action on, and no one could be that naive and stupid to sort of look around and completely faultless. I think when you see people who are more, when you have characters that are more complex, that yes, they may not appreciate what's going on around them because society, you know, was very different back then, certainly for Florence, but also that they are making their own mistakes. It makes them very human, and it enables you to carry on with their story in good faith, I think.
Yeah. And ultimately, it just makes them more believable when they're making mistakes, because everybody makes mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. And she was one of them. Yeah. I think it's important not to portray any character in a book as perfect, because they're not.
What drew you to the Gothic then? Your first book was Gothic fiction. You've carried on, you've brought true crime into it, but Gothic seems to be in your heart. And I'm saying this, and I'm looking at your beautiful writing cave, which is very colourful, which is very pretty.
Which is not Gothic.
No, it's not Gothic. But you're drawn to this. What draws you to the Gothic?
It started out in high school. I was reading Agatha Christie's Jane Eyre, Dracula, Frankenstein. They're some of my favorite books, you know. And early on, I didn't even know that was Gothic. All I knew was that I liked the darkness of those books and how the character gets out of it and what she's doing while she's trying to get out of it. Why is she isolated? How is she finding her strength? Does she find her strength? I love that. And when you add in the period that for the first two books I've written in, which is the Victorian period, you have this wonderful era in which the world is growing. There's the revolutionary era. Things are becoming mechanized. There's so much that's happening in terms of invention and speed. And yet women are still held in this gilded cage of, this is how I need to behave. This is how I need to dress. I can't do this like a man does because that will ruin my reputation. So you had all these modern inventions that are speeding along, and yet women are sort of kept in this, I don't know what you want to call it, this place where they're not allowed to grow as the world is. And I love to add the Gothic to that, because then it just makes it all the darker. But I will say, once you get to the end of the book, you don't feel like everything is still completely dark. Like there's some sort of win by the end of the book that that where the characters or character is somehow redeemed.
Yeah, and I think that's fair. I think in the Gothic, most of the classic Gothic literature we've read did not have a great ending because it's sort of people hoisted by their own petard and, you know, the human folly. That's you know, that's what the Gothic looks at a lot of the time. But it doesn't mean you can't have a happy ending after people have been through this, so that you can't have hope as well.
Yeah.
Because, there, you know, there can't be light without darkness and vice versa.
Right. And it's not a perfect happy ending. It's probably not the ending they would have written for themselves, but it is better in some way. And they've learned to adjust to that.
Yeah. When you were doing the research then for the book, the historical element of it, you talked about that this has been a year in the process of putting this book together. I don't know how you feel about the split between writing and being in the beautiful, in inverted commas, you know, the lovely creative space of like, I can write and I can craft my characters and the words and the research of it. Was it an even split or was it very much one took much more time than the other? And but also, what was the historic research like?
Early on, I did a lot of research, a lot of books, a lot of online places. I think, though, if I look back, there was probably less research than there was writing and editing again. As I said, I went from based on to inspired by. So I think I think in the end, the split was more heavy on the writing. I'd love to find a story where there's a lot of research to dig into. I don't know what I would do if I had to write a story that didn't have a lot of research. This one just had so much. It was all nonfiction. There's not been a lot. There's only been one other book I can think of that's been fictionalized, which I don't even count. And we can talk about that later. But yeah, I found trial transcripts. I found a 600-page tome from a barrister who had researched the case, who had sat in the courtroom for those, 10 days? I mean, there was just a lot. And I was happy to find that because then I have what I need, but I can also parse out what I don't need. So it worked well.
It's an interesting dilemma, I suppose, because on one hand, you know, which is easier? There are some who would probably feel very intimidated by a case that is so well known and that has so much detail on it. Of, as you said, you know, the first time you wrote it, it's like, how do I accurately portray this and also have it enjoyable? Or you can have a story with very little research. And I guess some writers would go, well, I can turn that into anything, couldn't I? But also you're kind of rudderless and you go, well, I'm really taking liberties with this story and they're real people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it depends on the type of writer that you are. I was afraid that if I relied so heavily on the story that I wouldn't get anything wrong. But then I felt like by relying so heavily on the story, it was reading very long and very weighty with a lot of details. And it was freeing to actually take some of that out and make it my own. But again, as I said, that's, you kind of have to write it the wrong way first before you get it right eventually. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional.
Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thinking about Florence and all this time that you've spent with her story and transforming it and giving her a new ending, what do you think happened in the Florence Maybrick case? What do you think happened to her husband?
I think that it was slow suicide because he was self-dosing. And I think, you know, one of the twists in the book is that when they give him his autopsy, they don't find hardly any arsenic in him, not enough to have killed him. So, which was another thing, like, how is this woman going to jail for this when there's not enough poison in him to kill him? So I think he had been dosing himself for years, many times a day. I think his body finally hit the point where it wasn't survivable anymore. So when he started to become ill, he lay for 2 weeks at home. And I think in that amount of time, the arsenic that was in him exited his body naturally, as it would. So that by the time he died, there was virtually no evidence that it had, you know, that it had ever been there. That's what I think. And in terms of Florence or Constance in my story, it was a perfect storm in that house. There were so many things that happened at the same time. It was easy to see her convicted when in reality, you had a lot of betrayal, you had a lot of bitterness, you had jealousy, you had this sinister aspect of people wanting to see her fall, and all of those things contributed to what happened to her ultimately.
It often makes me think with Florence Maybrick, I do think about the Adelaide Bartlett case. Now, I don't know if you covered that as well or you looked into it, but you'd had just only a short few years ago, I think it was 1885, but Adelaide Bartlett, whose husband had died from poisoning, but they had no idea how she did it. Famously, he died with chloroform in his stomach. There was no way of knowing how it got in there. Now, if he was examined now, you'd probably be able to find it out. But when she was acquitted, but famously, a lawyer sort of walked out and spoke to the press and goes, she should tell us how she did it, because everyone was foxed by it. And I often think, you know, is there a bearing on that where you've got something that's so mysterious and everyone was so frustrated at Adelaide Bartlett getting away apparently with murder? Then you come to someone like Florence Maybrick going, well, we're not sure entirely, but let's not take any chances. Those cases are often placed together because they're only about 4 or 5 years apart.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one. The Pimlico Mystery, it's called that one.
Is this the case where there wasn't any evidence that he had taken it orally?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah,
okay. So they really don't know how.
There was no sign of burning or anything in his mouth. It's so frustrating because I think in the Victorian era, there were so many poisoning cases that could be proven, and people did do tests and people could see these things that could so clearly point out that this has been someone who has been strategically poisoned over several weeks with a high dose and that they've been killed. You know, with Florence, it was a case of, well, we're really not sure, but let's convict her anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And the way that the charge was read, or the way that the original charge was worded, was that he had to have died of arsenic poisoning first. That needed to be proved.
Yes.
And then if that was proved, and only if that was proved, then they had to prove that it was willful murder on her part, that she had deliberately poisoned him. But they ended up commuting her sentence because when they looked back and she, you know, she was found guilty because there wasn't any evidence, really. They hadn't really proved that there was enough arsenic in his body to have killed him. Yeah. So, but she still served time.
She did.
Which, again, and then one thing I haven't mentioned, too, is that the British legal system at that time wasn't working in her favor either, because she couldn't testify on her own behalf. Defendants didn't have the opportunity or right to do that. And there was no appellate court at the time. So there were a lot of mistakes made at trial that shouldn't ever have allowed the trial to proceed, including the judge's own bias.
Yes, yeah,
but
famously.
There wasn't any way for her to ever go back and get an appeal. There was no legal groundwork to do that.
Yeah.
although many people tried. Her own barrister tried for years.
He tried very hard. Definite credit to you, Tonya, for taking the story, for giving it that lovely gothic twist and that setting, but also giving Florence an ending. I personally found the ending very satisfying. I really, really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the way where you took it. I thought that was great. And it was good to, you know, actually have an ending for one of our people who sort of wandered off like, oh, okay, that's a bit sad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And keeping them going.
Thank you.
What I wanted to ask is about your writing process. Now, I love to hear about people's writing process. I love the details. Do you have a particular writing process that you follow when you're crafting?
I didn't with the first book. This book, because I knew what was ahead of me, I knew that I needed to know a lot more about where I wanted to take the story and where I wanted it to go. Mm. Of course, that changed in the writing of it, like we've talked about. I try to do enough research to the point where I feel like I can begin and have a certain amount of knowledge about the era and the characters. But before even that, I really try and figure out who the character is, because I think my novels are more based firmly in character first before they are in story. And that's hard sometimes because in novels, even in short stories, characters have to have an arc. Real people don't live their life in character arcs. So you have to figure out what that character arc is for them in the story, and does it make sense with the theme and, you know, all of those things. So I start with character, do enough research so that I feel like I know enough. And also I know I've done enough research when I just can't wait to start the story. When I just can't wait, that's usually a really good step. And then I get through the first draft, which is I call the vomit draft because it's horrible. And then it's just a matter of draft after draft after draft until I just can't pick at it anymore. Mm. And then it goes to beta readers, some good author friends of mine who will be very honest about what they think. And then it will eventually go to an editor who I pay to have a really good edit, who will basically pull it apart piece by piece and then put it back together, which I would recommend for anybody trying to write a novel. Always get the edit. It's the professional edit. It's very important because they're going to see things that you don't.
Do you have a routine when you're writing? Do you have, you know, your times or your little or things that you need when you're writing?
Only tea. I drink a lot of Harney and Sons cinnamon tea.
Ooh, nice.
Love it. I drink a lot of it. That's about it. I usually have the dog under my chair or behind my chair, but that's about it in terms of rituals.
I like it.
You must have heard some interesting rituals. I don't feel like mine are interesting.
No, very few people do. I think, you know, there was a series that you read every now and then of, you know, writer's rooms and sort of my routine. I love to read about morning routines. With writers, there are only a couple that I've ever heard of who were sort of like, yep, and I go and follow this regimen. But sometimes the more and more people go, oh no, I don't really have a routine. But then they go, but I have to be sitting at my desk and it has to be daytime. Or I can only write at night. Or I can only write on this laptop lying down, that people have said before as well. So I always like to ask and find out. So what does the future hold then? Are you already working on book three?
I am. Hey. Yeah. I'm about 35,000 words into a first draft. Oof. So it's early days yet. I'm going to go back to 1840 in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. There was a medical college there. Now, in the 1840s is before they had anesthetic for surgery. It's before they had germ theory. It was the time in medical colleges where students could sit around an operating theater. It was actually called a theater. And I found a wonderful, true-life doctor named Dr. Thomas Mutter, M-U-T-T-E-R, who was on the board of faculty there. He was the dean of surgery. And he was groundbreaking because he would take people who, by society, were termed monsters. I'm doing this in air quotes. Yeah. Because they had been born with birth defects like club foot, cleft palate. Maybe they had a tumor growing on their face or whatever. And he would operate on them for free. And he did that as long as they were willing to have a public surgery so that the students could learn from him. And he developed, believe it or not, all of these medical practices for surgery. And again, this is 1840 before they even had painkillers for surgery that plastic surgeons are still using today. Mm. And it's all about this medical college, which, of course, in the Gothic is very creepy.
Yeah.
Because this is where surgeries happen and people's legs get sawn off and, you know, the anatomists are alive and well. And it's about a mystery in that medical college in Philadelphia. Ooh, so.
Spine tingling. Can't wait. Okay, we look forward to that coming out. Well, now it's time for some quick fire questions. for you.
Okay.
Do you have a favorite author?
I have more than one.
Yep.
Maggie O'Farrell. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth McNeil. Those would probably be my top two. Also love Anthony Doerr.
Oh, yes.
Who wrote All the Light We Cannot See. Love him. Yeah. And they all write historical. Of course, right?
Of course. If you did something really modern, it'd be like, oh, interesting.
Yeah, right,
brother,
right.
Do you have a favorite book from childhood?
I don't know how far back you want me to go, but my favorite book is To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm. Before that, I don't know that I have one.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Yeah, it is.
Do you have, this is it's an either or question just in case, do you have a book that you're really looking forward to coming out or reading in 2024? Or if there isn't anything that's really high on the TBR list, do you have a book that you always recommend to people?
I don't have a book I always recommend because I have so many friends that have different interests, so it's really hard to do that. I love Elizabeth McNeil. She's English. She's had two books out now. Her third is coming out, I think, this summer, and it's called The Burial Plot. She's very gothic. Mm. I cannot wait for that.
Yes, I think I've seen that.
Can't wait. She just debuted her cover. She did a cover reveal and it's gorgeous.
Exciting. Hard copy or Kindle?
Preferably hard copy, but Kindles are often cheaper and I read so much that I feel like my budget often dictates ebook.
It's very diplomatic. I like it.
Yes.
With your hard copies, do you break the spine or do you leave it pristine?
I break the spine. Sometimes I highlight, I bend pages, something I like.
Oh, that must be the next question. You're an annotator?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I'm weird like that. It's nerdy, but I do.
No, it's a whole thing. People are giving kind of like guidance on how to annotate and all of the highlighters and the labels and everything. But you're in favor of annotating?
Yeah, for certain books. I mean, for something like a beach read, no, not so much. But something that's a little bit more heavier than that, absolutely, I will.
And the two very important questions. What is your favorite cocktail?
Lately, I'm liking aviations a lot.
Ooh, very
glamorous. I
love
the aviation. Yes, I love the creme de violette in them. I think I'm saying that right.
Yes.
You tell me. You speak French, yeah, right? You speak some French?
It's the same. Violette or violet. It doesn't matter. Violet. Yeah.
It's beautiful. It's lavender.
Gorgeous. Nick would be very proud. It's one of his favorites.
Oh, good.
It is. And finally, what is your favorite poison?
I'm going to have to say arsenic because that's what this book is about. Arsenic alarm! Arsenic alarm!
It's a classic for a reason. And it has so many uses.
Yes.
Oh, wonderful.
That's right. That's right.
Tonya, thank you so much for your time today. If you'd like to close by just giving people information of where they can access and read The Arsenic Eater's Wife, where can they get it and devour it? And if they want to follow you, any ways that they can follow you?
Okay. So you can find the book in the US and the UK on Amazon. You can also find it on bookshop.org. Reach out on my website to me at tanyamitchellauthor.com. On Instagram, I'm tmitchell.2012. I'm not really active on Twitter that much. And if Facebook at Tanya Mitchell Author.
Wonderful.
So that's about it. Thank you so much.
Not at all. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you and to be able to endorse the book as well. It is a gorgeous, gorgeous novel, and good luck with everything with it.
Thank you so much. This has been such a good time.
We hope you have enjoyed this latest interview with our latest expert witness. If you are a book reader, a book lover, a book eater, you might consider joining the Poisoner's Cabinet own book club, the Belladonna Book Club, on Facebook. This is a simple Facebook group that you can request to join if you are a fan of the show, where we pick a different book to read every 6 weeks. But also, this group is open to people who simply want to post about what they're reading, share bookish tips, have a conversation with some genuinely lovely people. We focus on a lot of gothic and spooky books, but different genres are picked and voted on by group members. In addition, our Patreon subscribers also get to join a regular book club Zoom meeting where you get to hang out with the Poisoner's Cabinet and talk about the book of the month. If you have other suggestions of expert witnesses you would love the Poisoner's Cabinet to interview, feel free to email us at thepoisonouscabinet@gmail.com or leave a message on any of the social media channels that you follow us on. Thank you for listening. In the meantime, keep reading, keep talking about poison, and remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.